Extraordinary Terrestrials, Chapter 33, A Stubborn Man. Why did Karen try to burn the bog? Bud asked. They passed a spot that had sustained considerable damage from the fires. The shrunken trees were charred, and though much of the moss had grown back over the summer and early autumn, it now had a dead gray hue from the soggy winter. Trip considered the possible answers he could give. Vengeance, temporary insanity, alcohol. I think there are many reasons she did it, he finally answered. Though I like to think it was because, like you and I, she was also afraid. Of the bog? Bud's tone lowered as if the singed blueberry shrubs and wilted pitcher plants could hear. Yes. Trip recalled the initial confused terror he'd felt upon discovering the missing driveway. They continued on in silence for several moments. Who was with you that night when Karen got eaten up? Bud asked. Trip hesitated before deciding there was little or no risk in giving the truth and no point in withholding it. My best friend Maddie. She still hadn't called. Trip was afraid to come to terms with the fact that she was never going to call. The thought lingered in his periphery, darkening all other immediate concerns. He couldn't stop from dreading the truth. Distraction helped. Having company like Bud helped because Bud knew little of Maddie and wasn't likely to bring her up. This was a reason for Trip to hesitate in telling him anything about Maddie. Your best friend is a girl? Bud asked, astonished. Yes. Trip didn't offer more. Do you have a best friend? I don't know, Bud mumbled. He looked away. Trip could tell it was a sensitive topic. You know, I never had a best friend until I met Maddie. He hoped this information would come as a comfort to Bud. And that was only 6 years ago. Nana and Gramps are always saying they're best friends, Bud offered. So I guess that's another example of a boy and girl being best friends, but they're married. Ah. Trip nodded, unsure of what he could add to this observation. How much farther? Bud asked. Just a little ways. See, we're to the corner now. Trip pointed down the familiar road of his home. That farmhouse there, that's where I live. How long have you lived there? Bud asked. My whole life, Trip answered, wishing he hadn't brought it up. I've lived with my grandparents my whole life, Bud replied. So did my mom, but she left a long time ago. Trip realized something. The name Hadlock had been ringing a bell for some time now, but he hadn't been able to place it until Bud mentioned his mother. It occurred to Trip that he hadn't even wondered about Bud's parents until that moment. Your mother was... Is her name Mary? Trip inquired with as much tact as he could muster. Yeah, how'd you know? I remember her from school. She graduated. She was a few grades ahead of me. Trip recalled the image of a very sad and angry girl in his head when he thought of Mary Hadlock. I didn't know her very well, just in passing. She ran away when I was 2, Bud explained it like he was describing a character in a book or a TV show, not his own mother. Didn't tell my grandparents where she was going. We still don't know where she is. Nana doesn't think she wants us to know. I'm sorry. It's okay. Bud continued with the same degree of nonchalance. Gramps told me that just because I wasn't born on purpose, that doesn't make me an accident. Some people are born on purpose, but no one becomes who they are on purpose. Not completely. He told me that because kids at school were calling me an accident for a while. That's terrible. They stopped once I stopped reacting, Bud rebutted. I just told myself that they were saying those things because their meanness was an accident, too. I've never looked at it that way, but you might be onto something, Trip replied. We're crossing again here, just one more street down. Were kids ever mean to you? Bud asked. As they crossed the street, Trip tried to recall any instances of his classmates' cruelty. Sometimes they'd laugh at me when I did something clumsy or when I talked about things they thought were boring, he replied once they were safely on the other side of the road. They weren't mean, but they weren't particularly nice either. I usually tried to stay out of the way and just do my own thing. That's smart, Bud commented. Maybe, but it doesn't help you make many friends either if you're always trying to go unnoticed. I guess I do have a lot of friends, but not at school, Bud explained. Trip regarded the boy, understanding something. All of Bud's friends were adults, people like Trip, Churchy, his grandparents, and their co-workers. Bud had no siblings, no younger peers. He thought playing make-believe meant pretending to have an occupation, like a forensic scientist or a lawyer. Trip recalled his own childhood sessions of make-believe when his occupations had been vague things like adventurer, investigator, researcher, or his favorite, observer. He was still happy to say these were his occupations, even though they made him no money. Bud's imagination seemed to be in the right place. He liked playing the role and learning as much as he could about that particular discipline. Trip saw nothing wrong with someone who liked to learn. Here we are, he stated, surprised by how easy it had been to find. The Historical Society? Bud asked. Trip frowned with concern, and Bud realized he hadn't hid his disappointment very well. What's wrong? I thought we were going somewhere that wasn't boring, Bud explained, no longer caring if Trip saw his dismay. He felt cheated of an adventure. They'd walked this whole way, only for Trip to bring him to what he assumed was a dusty old building full of paper. Trip rolled his eyes and made for the front door. Have you ever been here before? He asked. No, Bud admitted. Then you have no reason to be disappointed. Bud followed, sagging. I have every reason to be. His mumbles trailed off as he stepped into the warm air and was greeted by a large, cavernous room full of glass cases and the smell of aging things. He noticed something in one of the displays. Is that a sword? Not so loud, Trip cautioned. It's okay, it's a historical society, not a library, stated a woman neither of them had noticed. Bud jumped a little, finally seeing her seated at a desk. She nodded and gave a terse smile. Welcome. Feel free to sign the guest book. As Trip took the pen she'd offered him, she turned to Bud. It's a Union soldier's sword from the Civil War, she explained. Then she pointed to another, larger case. That's his uniform. Bud inched closer to the glass, examining the blue wool coat. Looks like a dress, he observed. As an afterthought to what he worried might have been insulting, he added, I like it. The historian laughed and passed the pen and guest book to Bud. He signed, paying close attention to Tripp's name and penmanship above his own. What brings the two of you here? The historian asked. Any particular inquiries? Well, actually, I do have something to ask, Trip started. The historian held up her hands. If your house is over 150 years old, yes, someone probably has died in it, she stated quickly. Bud laughed. Then he made a mental note to ask Gramps how old their house was. Oh, Trip struggled. No, that's not what I was going to ask, but, well, that is interesting. My house is at least from the 1850s. The probability of a death happening there never occurred to me. Likely an infant or the elderly, the historian added. Which house is yours? The farmhouse near the corner of Munson and Blueberry. Oh, yeah, on Munson? She asked. Trip nodded. A chief of police used to live there, but not for very long before another family moved in, and the grandfather died in one of the upstairs rooms, not sure which. Bud continued to peruse the glass cases, captivated. The way she'd said it really hit him. His uniform. A man, a real, living, thinking man with feelings and ideas, had once worn that scratchy-looking dress. That man had only known the time he'd lived in. He could only have imagined the world Bud existed in, just as Bud could only imagine the world people would live in 100 or 200 years from now. Maybe there wouldn't be any more wars, and no more soldiers' uniforms by then. The historian continued to tell the story of Tripp's house. So after the Halbertsons had their run of the place and sold off the surrounding woods for development and housing projects, I'm not really sure whose hands it came into. Whoever it was, it couldn't have been for a very long time before your family must have moved in. I'm guessing in the 90s? Unless one of your parents grew up there. I'm actually looking for any information you might have about a man who died 60 or so years ago. His name was John Caron, but I think he was known as Jack, Tripp stated, cutting into the historian's ambling monologue. The reluctance in his tone suggested he wasn't expecting much of an answer. Certainly not the answer the historian gave. Jack Caron, she said, eyebrows raised in disbelief. How did you come to hear of him? He's been presumed dead since the 60s. Didn't think anyone else was interested in his story. I am, Tripp replied. There was a shift in his tone. It took Bud aback, and he began to listen more closely to their conversation. Well, there's an interesting story there. Not that I've managed to unveil much, the historian began. He was an outcast in the purest definition. Came to this town when he was still fairly young, moved into an old derelict property by the bog. You know, Bloodsworth Bog. Anyway, he fixed it up. It's probably back to being derelict now. The road that used to lead to his cabin is completely grown over. People didn't like him much. Hard to say why. Some people just get a bad rap from the start, so he took to a hermit lifestyle, aside from the occasional friend. So he did have friends? Tripp interrupted. Bud found himself entirely absorbed now, and forgot the Union soldier's uniform for the time being. Pretending to still be interested in the displays, he listened and watched the conversation in the reflection of the glass cases. Just like a spy. Well, it's interesting, actually. The historian rested her elbows on the desk, settling into what was clearly her favorite mode, storytelling. He did have a few friends, but none seemed to stick around very long. One was a police chief who was briefly stationed in this town, the one who lived in your house, actually. They developed a friendly kind of alliance. See, people were always trying to pin crimes on Mr. Caron, so it helped to have someone of authority on his side. The law was kind of up to whomever was in charge those days. But eventually he and the chief had a falling out of sorts, hard to say why, and the policeman moved himself and his family out of town. Strange that Jack stayed and he left, if you ask me. Must have been a pretty stubborn guy. Did he have any other colleagues? Tripp asked. Maybe a woman in his life? The historian gave him a puzzled look. He did. Another outsider. She came from somewhere in New York and her name was Hecate Morris. Yeah, how's that for a mouthful? People were so creative with their names back then. Not that they aren't now, but... Well, anyway, she lived with him for a while, and it was rumored that they were a couple, so to speak. She, like Jack, was also prone to being pinned with scandal. Then she vanished, hardly a year or two after taking up with Jack. Everyone I've interviewed seemed to think it was Jack that was responsible for her disappearance. Is that what you think? Tripp asked. Judging by her journals, no. The two had a strange companionship, but I don't think it ever reached that kind of hostility. Nor do I think it was a romance. There's some mention of a husband in her writing, but I think they were separated. Honestly, I think Miss Maris and Mr. Caron were buddies. They worked together, sustaining the gardens and property, making money off the land, fending off unpleasant gossip. But she did seem the type to just run off and start a new life. That's probably what really happened. Sounds like a bad friend, Bud chimed in. He'd stopped pretending at this point and was now fully involved in the tale the historian was regaling. She seemed like a complicated person, the historian said with an agreeing nod. I don't think she was very good at keeping friends. Tripp shifted, waiting almost impatiently for the historian to stop talking so he could get his next question out. You mentioned she had journals? He asked. She had to. It was her sole means of communication. She was mute. What's mute? Bud asked. You know the button for the TV? The historian explained. The one that turns the sound off? Yeah. Just like that. Couldn't speak. It was like someone pressed that button for her. Probably the after effects of some illness or other that she'd had when she was young. Did damage to her vocal cords, and back then, American Sign Language was a new thing most folks had never heard of. Back when? Bud asked. Oh, the historian looked at the ceiling, calculating. Mid-20s was when she was recorded to have disappeared. 25? No, 24. Do you have her journals? Tripp asked, still on task. Some. We have 5, but who knows how many she actually had. The ones in our archives were actually released from police custody ages ago. Any chance I could borrow them? Tripp asked. But this isn't a library, Tripp, Bud reminded him. Correct, the historian agreed. And no, you cannot borrow them. They're rather brittle with age. Promise to be careful and you can read them here if you want. She turned, leading them to the basement staircase. Bud was the first to follow. I don't know how much time we'll have, but it's a start, Tripp replied, close behind. Thank you. Or you could scan them, the historian suggested as the idea occurred to her. Take them home on a thumb drive if you like. I'll warn you, though, they're not the easiest or most coherent read. Maddie finally arrived in town 25 hours after she'd set off from Ruston, nearly delirious with exhaustion. She'd only stopped for fast food and gas. She first made for Churchy's Hardware, but finding no sign of Tripp inside and not wanting to get stuck in a challenging conversation with Churchy, she quickly left. Tripp's house had a couch, and sleep had taken a top priority. So she turned onto Blueberry Lane. Passing the bog and witnessing the still red moss and pitcher plants amongst the burnt dead trees, Maddie was both nervous and excited to be back. She made an indignant sound when she noticed the fence, but she had little headspace to give it much consideration. She reached Tripp's empty house, climbing through a window she'd learned was never locked, and knowing he'd be there sooner or later. It seemed unreal to feel so much at home. She collapsed on his couch and gazed at the pile of books on the coffee table. Tripp's hands had put those books there. Tripp's hands had paged through them. Tripp's brown eyes had read the words inside. Her heart gave a single flutter of excitement. Then Maddie fell asleep. A few hours later, Phil Hadlock dropped Tripp back off at Churchy's. Bud waved from the window as the car took off. Tripp waved back, waiting only a second before hurrying to his bicycle. As he strode, he fiddled with the thumb drive in his pocket, pages after pages of Hecate Morris's journal entries, ready for him to read. He didn't notice the black car or the man leaning against it, until he heard someone clear their throat. Tripp glanced up and saw a gray-suited man in his late 60s, watching him. He stopped. "Can I help you?" he asked. "Perhaps," the man smiled. It wasn't a good smile. Tripp was not convinced in the least bit. "You're Mr. Smith?" "Yes," Tripp answered, put off by the formality. "And you are?" "My partner and I were hoping you could help us out with a few questions we have," the man said. He opened the back door of the car. "We are conducting some, well, what you would call research." "Would I?" The man's eyes darted from Tripp's face to his bicycle, to the bicycle spokes that were dented. Tripp made a connection. Black car. It could have been any black car, but he knew without knowing why that it had been that exact car which had hit his bike last May. He was not inclined to give the man anything until he understood his motives. "Who are you?" "Heller," a female voice called from within the car. "I don't think this is the most effective approach." "You call me sir," he said over his shoulder, quieter. There was an exasperated sigh, then another door opened. A woman, also in a gray suit, stepped out of the car. "Look," she said, addressing Tripp. "This will only take a few minutes. We just have some questions about the bog and Karen Laurent." "The bog?" Tripp hadn't expected that. "Are you the press?" The woman chuckled. "No," she answered. "We're a research team hired by the—"
"Reynolds,"
Heller cut in, his voice raising. They began to bicker out of earshot. Perhaps it was the investigative kick he was already in, but watching the two suited professionals butt heads made Tripp want to know more about them. He flipped the kickstand on his bike and pocketed his hands.
"All right," he interrupted their quiet argument. "What do you want to ask me?" "First, would you mind stepping into our office?"
Heller gestured to the open car door. "My partner seems to think we're mafia bosses. It's purely for discretion," Reynolds reassured. "The car won't even be running. We just don't want to be, we don't want any distractions." Heller gave Reynolds a seething glare but said nothing.
"Fine," Tripp replied.
He climbed into the back seat. The two returned to their respective seats, each slamming their respective doors. They turned to face Tripp, the leather upholstery squeaking.
"So," Reynolds began, "please verify that this is the correct spelling and pronunciation of your name,"
Heller interrupted.
"Tree Smith, and that's T-R-E-E Smith."
Tripp did a double take.
"I'm sorry, what was that?" "Your name is Tree Smith, correct?"
Heller read off a notepad. Tripp paused, wondering what their source of information was.
"Yes," he lied with a reassuring nod. "That's me. You live on 31 Mustard Way?"
Heller continued. Tripp was sure there was no such existing road.
"Absolutely," he lied again. "My whole life." "And,"
Heller squinted at the writing,
you have a twin?"
"I think he was saying his age, sir. I think he was saying 20.
"You're 20 years old?" Heller pretended he hadn't heard her.
"Definitely," Tripp replied, somewhat insulted that they thought he was that young. He quickly determined that their source of intel was churchy. It made perfect sense. The old man had likely rattled off the answers, well aware that they wouldn't copy any of it down correctly. Tripp felt an amused gratefulness for his boss.
"Okay, Tree." Heller flipped a page. "What do you know about Karen Laurent's relationship to the bog?"
"She owns it."
"Anything else?"
"She planned to develop it for business space." Tripp folded his arms.
"But you already know that, don't you? You look familiar. Did I see you at the hospital yesterday? Where were you the morning Karen was found unconscious on Blueberry Lane?"
"Here."
"Oh." Reynolds sighed. "Who are you people working for?" Tripp asked, deciding it was his turn. "Are you the ones that put the fence up around the bog?"
"Yes," Reynolds answered before her colleague could get a word in. though technically the research is being funded by the College of Natural Sciences at the unit.
Reynolds, that's enough.
The actual on-field research begins in April, she continued. But we hope to glean as much information as possible before we begin, seeing as how it is a rather unusual case.
Reynolds?
Heller warned again, to little effect.
It is an unusual case, Tripp agreed. Why do you say so?
Heller switched from irritability to intrigue at an alarming rate. Bogs are very unique ecosystems, Tripp explained, keeping it objective. Where else in North America, in Zone 4 no less, can you find more than one carnivorous plant species in the same ecosystem?
Heller stammered.
Bloodsworth Bog has at least three. It has to do with the soil, Tripp began, glad to give Heller exactly what he hadn't asked for. It's highly acidic due to thousands of years of slow decay. The plants, essentially trapped there, have water and sunlight, but they must use other means to get sustenance, since the soil offers little nutrition. Many of the species are very old and haven't had the need to evolve much. Pitcher plants attract insects using aesthetics and nectar. The insects fly down their big colorful throats and they swallow them up. The pitcher plants in Bloodsworth Bog have tiny hairs in their interior to aid in this process. Sundew, on the other hand, snags bugs with its sticky little limbs.
Okay, now slow down, Heller interrupted.
Of course, the two of you surely already know these things, seeing as how you're employed by the College of Natural Sciences, Tripp stated, knowing this would make them uncomfortable. Not employed, funded, Reynolds corrected. They'll be providing us with some interns.
Have you noticed anything unusual when passing the bog? Heller asked.
Unusual? Tripp noticed several blinking devices in the front of the car that didn't typically belong in a Ford.
I have lived near this bog my entire life. I've always considered it unusual, but I have no other bogs to compare it to.
Heller gave a short sigh, pinching the bridge of his nose.
I mean to ask, have you witnessed anything you would consider unnatural?
Tripp hesitated. Heller was seemingly peering into his soul while Reynolds waited patiently. Tripp would have gladly told the woman in the suit about all the unnatural occurrences he'd witnessed in Bloodsworth Bog. Reynolds seemed, like himself, an honest researcher. It was Heller's poorly concealed and manipulative intentions that kept Tripp silent. Heller sat on the driver's side. He'd been driving that night when the car hit Tripp, no doubt.
No, Tripp answered finally.
Heller tossed his notepad down in exasperation as Reynolds continued to watch Tripp. She knew he knew more. What about others? She asked. Anyone you know see anything strange? Surely your girlfriend passes by the bog to visit you at work frequently, Heller added with new vigor.
I don't have a girlfriend, Tripp answered quickly.
No? Heller smirked. We were led to believe you.
I don't, and even if she...
Tripp grew flustered. He silently cursed Churchy. If I do have a friend, and she happens to be a girl, you couldn't ask her about it. She's out of town for a while. He'd said too much. The two professionals gave a simultaneous raise of the eyebrows.
Yeah, okay.
Heller turned to face forward, buckling his seatbelt.
We thank you for your time, Tree, and your minimal cooperation. We must be on our way. It's getting late.
Indeed, the sky had darkened rapidly in the few minutes Tripp had spent in the car.
Certainly, he replied.
And if you think of anything, Reynolds said, then lowered her tone, or have any questions, you can reach us this way. She handed him a card with only a phone number written on it.
Thank you, he replied, opening his door.
He spoke over Heller's shoulder as he climbed out of the car.
Oh, and be sure to turn the headlights on this time.
Extraordinary Terrestrials is written, read, and recorded by Miriam Rimkunis.
All piano music was written and performed by Jonas Rimkunas. All public domain organ music was performed by John Rimkunas. All other music was written and performed by Miriam Rimkunas. Needless to say, all rights reserved. Tune in every Thursday for the next chapter. The Mockingbird heard at the beginning of this chapter was recorded in New Jersey by free sound user Hargis Sound. A link to their recording is in the show notes. If you like what you hear, please leave ratings and reviews for Extraordinary Terrestrials on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, or SoundCloud. You can also follow the podcast and tell your friends on Facebook and Twitter, as well as the website, extraordinaryterrestrialspodcast.com. Lastly, go outside! As summer reluctantly approaches, some of you listeners may be scoping out vacation spots. Some of you might be considering paying all the other vacationers a visit at Old Orchard Beach here in southern Maine. What you might not know is that there is a bog boardwalk just one town over from Old Orchard. The Saco Heath is located off Route 112, and it has a bounty of blueberry shrubs, pitcher plants, black flies, flowers, pines, and even a few Atlantic white cedars. If you want to visit, donate, or learn more about the Saco Heath, you can find it under the main chapter of the Nature Conservancy at www.nature.org. While you're browsing, see what protected regions are in your neck of the woods, or swamp, or desert. At the very least, go outside. Thanks for listening. Thank you.